This morning I'd like to finish up the section in this study on saving by talking about some of the benefits of saving, and then I want to get into investing, which is something I've been looking forward to, and I know some of you have also. That's kind of the more exciting part of this study, I think. Before I talk about the benefits, I have one thing to say about that is that I think it's important for all of us from time to time to take an account of our wealth. And this is a biblical principle here. If you look in Proverbs 27 in verses 23 and 24, we are told here in agrarian type language that we ought to be occasionally looking over our investments, our assets, our bank accounts, and so on, and seeing how we're doing and if we need to make any adjustments. Proverbs 27, 23 through 24. It says, "Be thou diligent." So that means that you ought to be on top of this. You ought to be, working hard at it and paying attention. "Be thou diligent to know the state of thy flocks, and look well to thy herds. For," connecting thought, "for riches are not forever, and doth the crown endure to every generation." So he tells you, number one, to take an account of your wealth, and then secondly, why? Because riches are not forever. They do make themselves wings and fly away as an eagle toward heaven. And just like a farmer in those days who had flocks and herds, if he wasn't diligent to pay attention to the state of the flocks and the herds, if he wasn't looking at his sheep regularly to see if they had infections and, whatever problems, if he wasn't paying attention to the fields to see if there was enough grass and enough for them to eat and enough water and things like that, if he wasn't paying good attention to his flocks, he'd eventually lose his flocks, right? They'd get sick, they'd die, they'd be attacked by predators and things like that. So he had to be diligent to take a look, to look well to them. And we can apply this principle, as I said, to our own lives today. We should be diligent to take an account of our wealth once in a while. I think it's a good idea to have a spreadsheet. Now, of course, I think it's a good idea to have a spreadsheet for everything in your life, to run your entire life on them, because, of course, that's what I do. That's not for everybody, but at least use a spreadsheet for this, because this, you don't have to, but it makes it a lot easier if you use a spreadsheet. Anyway, good idea to have a spreadsheet which contains all of your bank account balances, all of your investments, all of your assets, any cash you may hold, any other assets, physical assets that you may hold that are, of a monetary nature. It's a good idea to do that, I'd say at least once or twice per year. Take an account of things, see where you're at. Now, if you put this off because it's too much work and it's too much hassle to look everything up and to count everything up, then I would say you have a good problem. You have a good problem. If it's too much hassle, did you get what I said? Did it make sense? If it's too much hassle, say, I don't have time to log into all these different bank accounts, log into these different, my brokerage account, my 401k, my IRA, get the safe out, look at how much cash I have, count it up. It's so much work to do all this stuff. It's just a pain, and I don't get to it twice a year like I should. You've got a good problem. You've got a good problem. Now, if this is a simple thing for you and you do this every time you open your checking account balance and it takes you 5 seconds, I'd say you also have a problem. You don't have any retirement assets. You don't have any other assets, period. You've got the little pittance in your checking account. So, both extremes of that, I guess, are a problem. One's a good problem. One's a bad problem. All right, so next of all, and this will kind of, this point will factor into another point that I'm going to make later on in the sermon. So I will get back to that, Lord willing. So let's look at some of the benefits of saving. And there are a number of them. The first benefit of saving, and these are in no particular order, is financial freedom. Saving, having money saved up, having your emergency funds saved up, having retirement funds saved up, this gives you financial freedom. If you have money saved, you're not tied down to any particular job or even any particular location, right? You have the freedom to change your life if you want to. If need be, you can quit your job and find a less stressful one. There's a lot of people out there, that are stuck in their jobs. They have no choice but to continue in that job. Some people hate their jobs. Some people have very stressful jobs, but they have no choice. They can't quit. They have no freedom. It's because they're basically debt slaves. They're debt slaves. They have enslaved themselves, and that job is the only way that they can continue on living without going into bankruptcy. So they are forced to stay at a job that they hate or that is very stressful. And that's not a good way to live. I mean, sometimes that's your only choice, but that's not a good way to live. Here's another thing to consider as a Christian with financial freedom. If something happens to your church, you will have the financial wherewithal to move to be a resident member of another one. God forbid that happens. I didn't think it was going to happen in Minneapolis, and it did, right? So you never know what could happen. And that's another thing, another good reason to have financial freedom, to have money laid up, to not be tied down to a particular location. I know when I moved to Cincinnati, and I was a member of the Cincinnati church, at that point, like, I'd already left home, I'd already left everything, so there was nothing tying me down. And it was, in some ways, it was very sad, it was very hard. But in other ways, after I had done that, I was probably the freest man alive, because there's nothing holding me down, right? And I remember thinking and saying to myself, and I think I said it to other people too, if something happens to the Cincinnati church, I am only going to stay here long enough to pack the U-Haul, and I'm gone. I'm going to where there's another church. I'm going to be a member, a resident member of another church. And I could do that because I had financial freedom. I could quit my job. I could rent the U-Haul and spend $1,000 on that. I could move someplace else, start life over again, and look for another job if I wanted to, or maybe look for a job before I moved. But either way, you know, I had financial freedom, and that was a great feeling to think. It'd be a terrible thing to think, man, if something happens to my church, I'm stuck here. I'm upside down on my house. I'm up to my eyeballs in debt, and I can't move even if I want to, and now I'm stuck here. There's no church. I've got nothing here, and I want to be somewhere else, but I can't be because I'm strapped with debt. That's another reason to have money saved and to be financially free. Or when I was in Minneapolis, imagine this. Imagine if I would have been living like a normal American, okay, and in debt up to my eyeballs, no savings, no emergency fund, no nothing. And then the church falls apart there, and I couldn't afford to move. I couldn't afford the $1,000 or whatever it is for the U-Haul. I couldn't afford to continue paying the lot rent on my trailer for months while it sold after I left, and continue paying the lot rent and the rent down here and take a big pay decrease to come down here. Imagine if I would have been in a pitiful financial condition. I've been stuck. Stuck. That's no way to live. So if you have savings, you have financial freedom. And it can even spill over into your spiritual life. All right, another benefit of saving, and that is financial security. The Bible teaches us that money is a defense. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 12. For wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense. But the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. So two things here the Bible tells us in this one verse are a defense. Wisdom is a defense. Money's a defense. Now, if you put those two things together, if you have wisdom and money, you are living in a fortress. I mean, you have all kinds of defense because you've got wisdom and money. It's great to have both. If you only have wisdom and no money, you are still vulnerable. Right? You can have wisdom but no money, and you know, there's going to be all kinds of things that come along that really cause you a lot of trouble. But the thing is, if you have wisdom and no money, that situation is probably not going to last very long. Because if you have wisdom, you're going to get money. You're going to save money. You're going to invest money. You're going to build wealth, right? You're going to do what the Bible says. You're going to do what you've learned in this series over the course of months. And so if you have wisdom, you're not going to be broke for long if you actually do what wisdom says. And if you have wisdom, you will do what wisdom says. You'll put these things into practice in your life, and you will have money. If God blesses you to have money, and he hasn't chosen poverty for you. He has chosen poverty for some people. So that's possible too. Now, if you have money but no wisdom, you will soon have neither. If you have money but no wisdom, you will soon have neither. And you're not going to have any defense. But money is a defense. If you think about it, poor people are vulnerable to harm from any one of a thousand troubles that they may face. If you're poor, you're paycheck to paycheck, you are vulnerable to, I couldn't in the next hour list off all the things you're vulnerable to. Anything. A leaky roof, HVAC going out, a car wreck, a flat tire, a broken bone, anything. Literally anything, any problem in your life, you are vulnerable to if you are broke. A man named Clifton Jones said the following, I like this. He said, I never been in no situation where having money made it any worse. Grammar's not exactly perfect there, but what he's saying is right. I never been in no situation where having money made it any worse. Think about that. I think he's right. You know, I don't want to break my leg, but I'll tell you what. If I break my leg and I've got the money in the bank to cover the medical expenses and to cover my job loss for the next, you know, weeks or months, breaking my leg stinks, but you know what? Having the money definitely made it a little better, right? Having your HVAC go out stinks, but if you got the money to write a check for a new one, you know, not as bad as it would have been, is it? And of course, there's a million other examples. Now, a warning, while money is a defense, we must never trust in it. Let's look at 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17. 1 Timothy 6:17. It is a defense, but it is not to be solely relied upon. You must rely on the Lord, and then he might use your money to defend you. But if you start relying on your money, he might take that money away from you because he doesn't like to have any challengers in your life. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. See, we must trust in God, and you always want to be careful about that. You want to be careful that when riches increase, you don't set your heart upon them and you don't trust in them, because there's always that temptation. There's always the temptation to be like the man in, was it in Luke 12, when his barns brought forth plenty, and he says, what shall I do? I'll pull down my barns, I'll build greater ones, and then I'll say to my soul, soul, thou hast much laid up for many years, eat, drink, and be merry. Right? He was trusting in his riches. I got no problem. My barns are full. I'm good for the rest of my life. I'm just going to kick back and just enjoy myself. God says, thou fool, it'll be taken from you this very night. You know what his problem was? Well, he was trusting in riches, that's pretty obvious. But secondly, he wasn't rich toward God. He wasn't giving back any of that to the Lord that the Lord gave him. And the Lord took his life from him. Now, Proverbs 18, verse 11. Proverbs 18 and verse 11. Never trust in it. The rich man's wealth is his strong city. See, it's a defense. And has a high wall in his own conceit. Yes, his riches are. It's a high wall in his own mind anyway. He thinks that his riches are going to protect him. He thinks that nothing bad's ever going to happen to him because his money is there as a defense. Well, it's fine for money to be a defense. It's fine to have their horse prepared for battle. But you start trusting in that money instead of the Lord, and you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in trouble. All right, next reason. Next benefit of saving is financial peace. Financial peace. So we got financial freedom, financial security, and now financial peace. Joe Lewis said, I don't like money actually, but it quiets my nerves. I don't like money actually, but it quiets my nerves. There's a lot of truth to that. This is true for, I don't know if it's universal, but it's true for most women, I think. Money quiets their nerves. Dave Ramsey talked about this in one of his books, or maybe two of his books, I don't remember, that the emergency fund is especially good for wives. It quiets the nerves because women worry about that kind of stuff. You know, women are wired that way. But some men are too. I mean, I'll be honest, money quiets my nerves. If I was living paycheck to paycheck, like so many are, I'd be a wreck. I mean, I don't like that. I like having padding. I like having an emergency fund. I don't like living on the edge at all. I don't even like getting close to the edge. I mean, I like to err way on the side of caution. That's not for me. So, I know people that live just the opposite, and I just think the way that they live would drive me to a mental institution. I could not handle it. Just living right on the razor edge all the time. It's not for me. Thomas J. Stanley in The Millionaire Next Door, which I've quoted so many times, he wrote, financially independent people are happier than those in their same income age cohort who are not financially secure. You see, being financially independent, having that money saved up, having the wherewithal to take care of yourself if a calamity happens or, you know, in old age and things like that, when you have that, that brings peace and happiness. And I think it makes sense that he's right. If you just imagine, take two families, okay? Everything is equal with these two families. Handsome husband, beautiful wife, wonderful personalities, awesome marriage, four beautiful kids each. Kids are smart, well-behaved. Everything's great. They have a nice house. They have a nice social life. They've got lots of friends. They've got family that live close by. They're both in the church. They got everything. Everything. And it's all perfectly equal. Except for one thing. One of them lives paycheck to paycheck. And one of them has 6 months living expenses saved up in an emergency fund, has no debt, has the house paid off, has $800,000 in his 401k. Which one's going to be happier? Which one's going to be happier? I think it makes sense, right? The one that's financially secure, that has financial peace, you know, all things being equal, he's going to be happier, is he not? Money doesn't buy happiness, but, you know, it certainly makes a good situation better, and it makes a bad situation worse, right, if you don't have it. A few pages later in the book, he writes, too many high-income, low-net-worth types live from paycheck to paycheck, fearing a sudden downturn in the economy. See, if you're in debt up to your eyeballs and you have no money saved, you've got no emergency fund, then you really worry when you start reading headlines about recessions and about, you know, things turning down. You're really stressed out about that. No, it'd be stressful for anybody, but it's a lot worse when you don't have that money saved up. It's interesting there, he says, many high income, low net worth types. To most people would think that's an oxymoronic statement. How can you be high income, low net worth? That's the way most people are. I mean, that's the way most high income people are. Most high income people are low net worth. They got a lot of income. They got a lot of cash flow. They don't have any money saved up. They got a lot of debt. It's very interesting. I mentioned the other book on millionaires that I was reading by Dave Ramsey. And I might mention this later, but only 3% of millionaires drive Mercedes. 3% of millionaires drive BMWs. 3% of millionaires drive Audis. The only luxury car that millionaires drive with any great percentage are Lexuses, and I think about 8% of them. So, but take your average Mercedes. 3% of millionaires drive Mercedes, okay? And I forget what the percentage of the population is that are millionaires, but it's a very low percentage. So you don't have very many millionaires to start out with, and only 3% of the few millionaires that are out there drive Mercedes. But I see Mercedes driving around all the time. I mean, not like Fords, right? But Mercedes are being driven. I see them every day, right? If you wanted to make money, start betting people. You see a guy driving in a Mercedes, you could lay down money every time and say, I'll bet you that guy's not a millionaire, and somebody else will bet you, I bet he is a millionaire, you're going to win every time, because there is a very slim chance that the person driving that Mercedes is a millionaire. It's just really interesting. Millionaires are not what you think. I'll mention this later on too, but you know, millionaires, the average millionaire actually spends less on groceries, less on eating out, and less on clothing than the average American does. And this is based on the largest study of millionaires ever. 10,000 millionaires studied, scientific study. They spend less on groceries, less on eating out, and less on clothing than the average American does. And they live in a house that is just slightly smaller than the average new American house. And of course, as the old saying goes, that's why they're millionaires. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. I'll talk about that later, though. But if you have money saved, you don't have to worry about when the roof needs replaced, the foundation starts leaking, the HVAC system goes out, the car engine blows up, or you have an expensive medical need, right? So it gives you financial peace. And then I had this epiphany here several months ago. I was out walking one morning, and I just had this thought just struck me. If you manage your money foolishly and save little, at the end of your life, when you look at your bank account and consider the amount of money that you've earned over your lifetime, and you know the average person earns about $2 million in his lifetime. $2 million the average person does. You think that sounds like a lot. Very simple math. $50,000 a year times 20 is a million, right? $50,000 a year times 20, that's 20 years, is a million. $50,000 a year times 4 is 40 is 2 million. 40 years of working, 25 to 65. Most people work at least 40 or 45 years. Average income, especially average family income, is a lot higher than 50,000. Even average individual income is probably close to that in most places. So the average person makes 2 million a year. Even if you consider, you know, years ago you didn't make as much, average person made at least a million a year. Okay, so just that's the amount of money that the average person brings in over the course of a lifetime. Let me read the sentence again without all that commentary. If you manage your money foolishly and save little, at the end of your life, when you look at your bank account and consider the amount of money that you've earned over your lifetime, you will ask yourself in bewilderment, where did it all go? Where did it all go? $2 million, and this is what I have to show for it. Where did it go? You just think, I don't even know. I can't even figure out what happened to it. I wasn't robbed, except by the government. But other than that, I wasn't robbed, right? Where did it go? But on the other hand, if you manage your money wisely and frugally at the end of your life, or much sooner than the end of your life, when you look at your bank account, regardless how much money you made or earned over time, you will ask yourself in bewilderment, where did it all come from? Where? You're just looking like, how did this happen? I didn't get an inheritance. I didn't get, you know, some big windfall. I didn't sell some business. I just worked. I was just a normal guy. I just made a normal wage, and I just lived frugally and responsibly, and I saved money as I could. And you just look at this, you're like, how did this happen? Where did all this money come from? So in either way, if you live wisely or live foolishly, someday you're going to look at your bank account and be shocked. Either one way or the other. Where did it all go or where did it all come from? One of the two. Now you want to be the latter. And if you don't believe me, just do an experiment for the rest of your life and check it out at the end of your life. You'll find out one way or the other. One way or the other. All right, now before I get into investing, I want to talk about one more thing, and that is a warning against greed. I want to be careful about this one. Anything can be done to excess, obviously, right? Saving is good. Being greedy and hoarding it all for yourself is not good, right? That's bad. Greed is inordinate or insatiate longing, especially for wealth, avaricious or covetous desire. So it's that person that just can't get enough, right? It just has to get more and more and more and more. You know, there's a verse, I just thought of a verse. It's not in the outline. It's in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, I think. Is it verse 8? This is an excellent example of such a fellow. Glad that popped into my head. Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 8. There is one alone, and there is not a second. Yea, he hath neither child nor brother, yet there is no end of all his labor. Neither is his eye satisfied with riches, neither saith he, for whom do I labor and bereave my soul of good? This is also vanity, and it is a sore travail. His eye can't be satisfied. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, as it says. He just keeps working, keeps amassing money. It's never enough. And he never stops to say, what am I doing? I've got neither child nor brother. I've got nobody relying on me. I'm all by myself here. I'm just amassing all this money for what? What am I doing? I'm not even enjoying my life. Right? But that's the nature of a greedy person when it's just never enough. He's not amassing wealth so that he could be generous and give it to other people. That's a great reason to amass wealth. That's the most exciting thing about getting wealthy, is being able to be generous toward others with it. To have real money, to be able to step in and make a real difference in somebody's life. I mean, that's a huge blessing. That's a great reason to build wealth. But that's not why this guy is doing it. He's just laying it up because he's greedy. Wants it for himself. You see, saving is good, but being greedy and miserly is not. It tells us in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 9 that they that will be rich fall into a snare. It doesn't say that they that are rich falls into a snare. Maybe they could be. But they that will be, a person that his overarching desire is to be rich for the sake of being rich because he just wants to have a lot of stuff, that person's going to fall into a snare. For one thing, he's probably going to fall into these foolish get-rich-quick schemes. He's probably going to buy the latest cryptocurrency because somebody told me it's going to go up by 100 times in the next 6 months. Right? That's what the whole crypto thing's about. Yeah, you can make a lot of money in it. You can lose a lot of money in it too. But that's really what it comes down to. Why do all these people buy Bitcoin and crypto? It's because they think it's going to go up exponentially very fast, and they're going to get rich quick. They're going to get rich by doing nothing. And a lot of them did. But it can go the other way also. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 9. But they that will be rich, that want to be, that desire to be, they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. There's a big difference between the guy that just says, I want to be responsible, I want to be a good steward, I'm going to put away 15% of my income to build it up so that when I get old and I can't work anymore, I'm taken care of and my wife's taken care of, I've got an inheritance to leave to the children, and I've got wealth that I can be generous and give to others with. That's a whole different ballgame than the guy that will be rich. That's a totally different attitude. That guy's going to fall into a snare and foolish and hurtful lusts. Because the love of money is the root of all evil, it says in the next verse. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. See, it's not money. People misquote this verse all the time. Money is the root of all evil. Money is a physical thing. Right? Money's a piece of paper. Not really, but that's like what people think money is. Money's a piece of gold. It's a piece of silver, whatever. Right? Money is not evil. You know, an element on the periodic table is not evil. Right? Gold is no more evil than cadmium or helium. Right? I mean, think about it. Right? Money is not evil. The love of money is the root of all evil. The love of money. That insatiable desire where you live for money. All you ever think about is money. All you want is money. Right? The love of money. That's the root of all evil because you will do whatever you have to get it. Greed will make a man do terrible things. Let's look at Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs 1 and verses 10 through 19. Proverbs 1, 10 through 19. Here's what greed will do to a person, or can do to a person anyway. Proverbs 1 and verse 10, my son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause, let us swallow them up alive as the grave and whole as those that go down into the pit. We shall find all precious substance. We shall fill our houses with spoil. See? Let's go kill people. Let's go prey on the innocent so that we can enrich ourselves. Cast in thy lot among us. Let us all have one purse. Is it any wonder that people that think like this are communists? Let us all have one purse. Collectivism. My son, walk not thou in the way with them. Refrain thy foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird, and they lurk privily for their own blood. They lay wait for their own blood. They lurk privily for their own lives. See, what they're actually doing is going to end up in their own demise. They think they're laying wait for other people's lives. They got another thought coming, right? Their own lives are what they're really laying wait for. They're going to end up in their own destruction. So are the ways. Here's the punchline. So are the ways of everyone that is greedy of gain, which taketh away the life of the owners thereof. Think about Jezebel. Ahab wanted the vineyard of Nabal. Nabal wouldn't give it to him, wouldn't sell it to him. Jezebel has him killed so that Nabal can have his vineyard, right? Took away the life of the owner thereof because of her own greed. Let me give you another example. Ezekiel 22 and verse 12. The key to everything is moderation and balance. Moderation and balance. You don't want to be foolish and not have a care in the world about money because it's not going to end well for you. But on the other hand, you don't want money to be the sole driving influence in your life and want it above everything else. I mean, that's obviously way, way too far. You're going to get into all kinds of trouble. Ezekiel 22 and verse 12. In thee have they taken gifts to shed blood. Thou hast taken usury, that's interest on loans. Thou hast taken usury and increase. Thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbors by extortion and hast forgotten me, saith the Lord God. You see what happens to people that are greedy? They'll end up extorting their own neighbors, ripping off people, robbing them, in other words, in generally illegal way. Jesus said that you can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve God and money. You're either going to love the one and hate the other, or you're going to hold to the one and despise the other. He said you can't have two masters. You can't serve God and money. It's going to be one or the other. You serve money, you're not serving God. And if you're serving God truly, you're not going to be serving money. You can use money, but you're not going to be serving money. Money can be your servant. See, money should be your servant. You shouldn't be its servant. It should be your servant. It should not control you. You should control it. Now, greedy men are sometimes drawn into the ministry, believe it or not. They're generally not drawn into this type of ministry, ministry in true churches, right? But they are drawn into certain types of ministries, like televangelism ministries, where the money's really at. Let me just give you a couple of verses here. Isaiah 56 and verse 11. Anybody in a Sovereign Grace Independent Baptist Church that gets an idea, you know what, I want to get rich, and I'm thinking probably the quickest, easiest way is, I'm going to go be a pastor. That guy needs committed to an insane asylum. Isaiah 56 and verse 11. The Lord will provide for your needs by going into the ministry, but chances are you're not going to get rich. Isaiah 56 and verse 11. Yea, they are greedy dogs, which can never have enough. They are shepherds, and they are shepherds that cannot understand. These are shepherds, pastors, in other words. Greedy dogs, they're called. Shepherds that cannot understand. They all look to their own way, every one for his gain from his quarter. See, here are shepherds, pastors, that are in it for the money. They're in it for the gain. They can fleece the sheep. And you know, believe it or not, I think I told you about this before. I have actually been accused of being a greedy dog. I have. I had this verse. I think it was this exact verse. This verse applied to me. Pastor Wider is a greedy dog. And you know what my grievous transgression was? I published a book. This is one of the Proverbs books. I published a book and I emailed people on my email list and said, hey, I published a new book. If you're interested, here's a link. You're a greedy dog. A greedy dog. Because I didn't give it away. Except it was, you could read the whole thing online. I mean, it's all there. It's in piecemeal, right? It was all in a series of blogs that you could have read the whole thing. But as if I have to put all this work in and then just give it away, I don't know why. I hate to tell you, I mean, I'll gladly tell you what I made from that book. I don't remember what it was, but it was like maybe a couple of $100 or so. I don't remember. And for, I don't even know if it was that much. I don't remember. It wasn't very much money anyway, whatever it was. And if you figure that out at an hourly rate, I'd have been a lot better off flipping burgers at McDonald's. Let me tell you that. I didn't write the dang thing that I should call it. I didn't write it for the money, obviously. But anyway, this is what this internet preacher was called, a greedy dog. Unbelievable. And you know what? The same internet preacher had a bunch of books on Amazon that he'd written that he was selling. But he gives them away for free also, right? So he's not a greedy dog. And then I looked at how many at his page count and what he was charging, because, you know, that's where you can make your money if, you know, when you get to a certain point, you can price your book however you want on Amazon. And, but, you know, there's going to be a certain baseline cost for a certain page count. So below a certain amount, you don't make anything. Amazon just gets their part, you get nothing. So the more you increase your price above that level, you know, you can make a little bit more money. Well, guess what? He was charging a lot more per page count than I was for my books. Here's the greedy dog out there, right, that had priced my books way lower than he priced his books. But, you know, Mr. Virtuous out there, he's charging more for his. So, anyway. Ignore them. That's what you do with people like that. Judges. Not judges. Jude. Let's go to Jude. Jude 1 and verse 4. Jude 1 and verse 4 and then verse 11. For there are certain men crept in unawares who were before of old ordained to this condemnation, ungodly men turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. So you got these people that creep into the church, spiritual creeps here. They come in there and they have an agenda. They're doing this for other reasons than serving the Lord. And we find out what that other reason is in verse 11. Woe unto them, he's talking about the same people. Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Kori. They've run greedily after the error of Balaam. See, one of the reasons why these men had crept into the churches was to end up being benefited financially and monetarily. So this is why a pastor should make sure that, you know, such a man is not in it for the money when he's considering somebody to ordain. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, this is one of the qualifications for a pastor. Like I said, this is probably not a problem in most of our churches. Nobody's going into this job for the money. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, not given to wine, these are the qualifications. No striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous. So no, a pastor can't be greedy of filthy lucre. We're told in Proverbs 28 and verse 20 that they that make haste to be rich shall not be innocent, but they have an evil eye. Proverbs 28, 20 and 22. That's the problem. Making haste. Anytime you're in a hurry to make money, bad things are going to happen. Money, acquiring money is a slow and steady thing. I'll talk about that later on yet today. Anytime you're in a hurry to do it, bad things are going to happen, most likely. Proverbs 28 and verse 20, a faithful man shall abound with blessings, but he that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent. He might cheat, he might lie, he might steal, or he may just do something really stupid, like I said, invest in some get-rich-quick scheme and end up broke. Verse 22, he that hasteth to be rich hath an evil eye and considereth not that poverty shall come upon him. That's happened to a lot of people that tried to get rich quick. I heard it was on the Ramsey Show. It's a good radio show to listen to. You can listen to it on podcast. You'll just learn you'll learn stuff about finances, but you'll learn a whole lot about life, because people call in there with all kinds of problems, life problems, and I just love to hear what their answers are, because I listen to what the person says and I think, how would I answer that? I'm like, well, that's a tough one. And then they give them the answer. I'm like, a lot of times I'm like, that was good. So, you know, you just keep listening to that. You can really gain a lot of wisdom into all kinds of things. But anyway, this poor lady calls in. Her husband had, I forget how much he had in a 401k. It was a couple hundred thousand or something. It was a decent amount of money, and he was in his late 50s. But he wanted to make sure that he had enough. And so he bought into some stupid crypto scheme, cashed out his 401k, and it was gone. The person just robbed him, some guy in Thailand or something. So terribly sad. Didn't even tell his wife about it and lied to her about it, and then eventually came clean. But anyway, that kind of thing. Never, 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 never. Don't invest with some guy that's going to double your money, you know, quickly or something. Goodness, get some counsel from somebody that has some sense before you do anything like that. Now, Proverbs 23:4. We should not work just for the sole purpose of getting rich. Proverbs 23:4. Labor not to be rich. Cease from thine own wisdom. You know, it shouldn't be your overarching goal is to get rich. To provide for your family, that's one thing. I mean, you got to do that. And in order to do that, you have to have money laid up, right? There's nothing wrong with laying up money. But laboring to be rich, that's another story. All comes down to your motivation. Those that hide their eyes from the poor are cursed, we're told. Proverbs 28:27. See, I told you some of these sermons in this series didn't have much scripture, and then some of them have a bunch. So it all evens out. Proverbs 28:27. He that giveth unto the poor shall not lack, but he that hideth his eyes shall have many a curse. Now, why would you hide your eyes from the poor? Because you're greedy. You don't want to give. You don't want to give. You don't want to help them out. You want to keep it for yourself. So you say, I didn't see that. I didn't hear that. I'm not talking about infomercials of people in Africa or something. I'm talking about people in your own life that you find out that need help, and you say, I didn't hear that. Now, if you're broke, that's one thing, right? You can't help people when you're broke. That's why it's important to build wealth, to be able to help people. I think that's, like I said, one of the most exciting things about building wealth is being able to give generously. Proverbs 29:7. The righteous considereth the cause of the poor, but the wicked regardeth not to know it. And like it says in another place in Proverbs, behold, we knew it not. You know, you say, oh, I didn't know it. Doth not he that pondereth the heart consider it? Shall not he render to every man according to his work? God knows whether you knew it or not. Those that will oppress and defraud the poor to increase their riches will be brought to poverty. Proverbs 22:16. Again, this is what greedy people do. Proverbs 22:16. He that oppresseth the poor to increase his riches, and he that giveth to the rich shall surely come to want. He that giveth to the rich shall surely come to want. I have American corporations, banks, and government written next to that. They are the ones that give to the rich. It's called corporatism. It's called getting in bed with government and getting all kinds of benefits and things. I'm not talking about tax breaks either. I'm talking about government contracts and things like that. I don't care about tax breaks. Give them all the tax breaks you want. They ought to give us all 100% tax break, if you ask me. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about all the government contracts and things like that. Those that are greedy of gain will trouble their own house. Proverbs 15:27. Proverbs 15:27. He that is greedy of gain troubleth his own house, but he that hateth gifts shall live. Gifts in the sense of bribes, not, you know, some gift for your birthday or something. But yeah, you're greedy of gain, you'll trouble your own house. Now, you may think it's only the rich that are greedy, right? It's, you know, they're the only ones that fall into that trap, but that's not true. Poor, lazy people can be greedy too. Proverbs 21, 25 through 26. Proverbs 21, 25 through 26. The desire of the slothful killeth him, for his hands refuse to labor. He coveteth greedily all the day long, but the righteous giveth and spareth not. Now this is a slothful man, which is a lazy man. Now I don't know about you, but I don't know very many wealthy, lazy people. Typically, the hand of the diligent maketh rich. Typically, slothful people are not wealthy. So this slothful guy here is most likely poor because he's lazy. And yet he coveteth greedily all the day long. So you don't have to be rich to be greedy. A guy named Antoine Rivaroli, if that's how you pronounce his name, he said the following. This is quoted from Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover. He said, "There are men who gain from their wealth only the fear of losing it." That's pretty powerful. There are men who gain from their wealth only the fear of losing it. And that's very true. When people become wealthy, then they start to have a real fear of losing it. They're looking at the market every day. They're concerned the market may crash, the market may go down, something may happen to my wealth, and they become obsessed with it, obsessed with losing it. So you want to be really careful about that when you are building wealth. You got to hold on to it with a loose grip. And then Myra Gagné had these wise words to say. She said, "People that have lots have nothing because they forget about Jesus and want more." People that have lots have nothing because they forget about Jesus and want more. Okay, now I want to get into investing. I want to see how much time I have. Okay, I do have some time. That's good. This is the fun part. This is really interesting. I hope I can get through all I want to here today. All right, investing. So, like I said, as we've been going through this series, I've been going through it in logical order. Started off with working to acquire wealth, and then saving. I really should have done giving, I guess, before saving, but anyway, we'll get to that later. But working, and then saving, and now investing. I'm not doing it in the typical American way of, you know, debt, and then a little bit of work, and then a lot more debt, and then more debt, and more debt, and more debt. You know, I'm not going about it in that way. We'll get to debt later. Investing. So investing is actually a biblical thing. Did you know that? You know that investing is biblical. Investing is called trading. You'll hear this if you read any financial news, if you follow financial markets at all, you'll always hear about traders. Traders did this, traders did that, or investors did this, right? Investors and traders are synonymous terms. Investing is called trading. To invest is to employ money in the purchase of anything from which interest or profit is expected. Now, especially in the purchase of property, stocks, shares, etc., in order to hold these for the sake of interest, dividends, or profits accruing from them. So that's what investing is. Trading is the action of the verb trade in various senses. The carrying on of trade, buying and selling, commerce, trade, or traffic. And then trade, the noun, is the literal definition is passage to and fro, coming and going, resort. Passage or resort for the purpose of commerce, hence the buying and selling or exchange of commodities for profit, commerce, traffic, trading. So you can see where trading in a financial sense came from the primary definition of trade, which is going to and fro, going from place to place, buying and selling, and commerce, exchanging. Now, trading and investing are permitted and even encouraged in the Bible. I'll give you just one verse here, and then I'll give you some other ones that will show how it's encouraged. In Genesis 34 and verse 10, just give you an example here. It's not like investing is some kind of a wicked practice that only the heathen do or something like that. The Bible has good things to say about it. Genesis 34 and verse 10. This is when the sons of Jacob were dealing with Shechem and Hamor, and they really didn't do him right. But anyway, in Genesis 34 and verse 10, "And ye shall dwell with us," this is they're talking to him, "and ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein." See, that's how you increase. You trade, and you trade, you get possessions. Nothing wrong with that. Now, there is a type of trading that is condemned, but it's only when it's practiced by the proud, wicked people in an ungodly manner. And this is like anything else. There's nothing wrong with eating, but yet eating is condemned in Scripture if you eat too much, or if you eat blood, you eat something you're forbidden to eat, or something strangled, or something like that. Drinking alcohol is fine, but it's also condemned in Scripture if you drink too much. Sex is good, but if it's done outside of marriage, it's condemned, right? So, you know, somebody that has an agenda or is ignorant could say, "I read in the Bible where eating, drinking, and having sex are all sinful." Well, there's truth to that, right? In certain contexts. Well, investing, trading could be sinful too in certain contexts, but not in all contexts. I'll just give you a couple of examples here. Ezekiel 27, 2 through 3. I don't want to belabor this point. It's probably pretty obvious anyway. Ezekiel 27, 2 through 3. "Now thou son of man, take up a lamentation for Tyrus, and say unto Tyrus, O thou that art situate at the entry of the sea, which art a merchant of the people for many isles, thus saith the Lord God, O Tyrus, thou hast said, I am of perfect beauty. Thy borders..." How far did I want to go? All I wanted to do is establish this as Tyrus. Okay, now move on down to verses 12 through 14. Here's what the Lord has to say about Tyrus. Verses 12 through 14. "Tarshish was thy merchant, by reason of the multitude of all kind of riches, with silver, iron, tin, and lead, they traded in thy fairs. Javan, Tubal, and Meshech were... they were thy merchants. They traded the persons of men and vessels of brass in thy market." Verse 14, "They of the house of Togarma traded in thy fairs with horses and horsemen and mules." Okay, so the point is, Tyrus is a wicked nation. They were doing trading. But that doesn't mean that trading is necessarily evil. It just means that this was the business that these wicked people were going about, and that's what their lives were all about, and the Lord was... condemning them for it. James 4, 13 through 16 talks about people that were going to go and go to this place and that place, and they were going to trade and buy and sell and get gain, and it was all just about what they were going to do, and they were giving no consideration to the will of God whatsoever. James 4, 13 through 16. "Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city, and continue there a year, and buy and sell and get gain." That's trading. That's investing. "Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time, and then vanisheth away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now ye rejoice in your boasting. All such rejoicing is evil." You see, so there is, it depends on the motives, whether trading is wrong or not. Now, what investing does is makes your money work for you. Okay, so in order to invest, you first have to save, right? That's why we covered saving first. And there's three things that you can do with your savings. Okay, once you have it saved, you can spend it, right? You can do nothing with it, or you can invest it. Those are pretty much the three things that I can think of that you could do with your savings. Spend it, do nothing with it, or invest it. Now, spending all of it is what fools do. Proverbs 21 and verse 20 says that there's oil and wine to be in the desired in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. Right? So a foolish man just takes his savings and blows it. What's the point of even saving? Doing nothing with it is what slothful, unambitious, and fearful people do. Remember the parable of the talents and of the pounds. Let's look at that in Matthew 25 and verse 18. Doing nothing. So you save up all your money and it just goes under your mattress or it goes in a coffee can or something. You do absolutely nothing with it. That's what slothful, unambitious, and fearful people do. And especially today, in those days at least, it would maintain its purchasing power because it was gold and silver coin. These days, you put paper dollars under a mattress and they lose probably 5-6% of their value every year, which it doesn't take long before they've lost half their value. That's compound interest going the other way. So these days, you just can't stash cash and think you're going to get anywhere. I mean, it's better than nothing, but you're going to continually lose money. Matthew 25 and verse 18. We already read this parable. You remember the man went and he gave 5 talents to one, 2 talents to the other, 1 talent to the other, and wanted to come back and receive more when he got home. And verse 18, but he that had received one went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. Didn't do anything with it. He just hid it. And the reason he did it, verse 24, then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I know thee, that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant. See, he gets right down to the brass tacks. No, you say you're afraid, but you're really lazy. You just didn't want to do anything. Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sow not and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. At least do something with it. I could get some interest. And then he's cast into outer darkness, and he takes his talent and gives it to somebody else. The same thing in the parable of the pounds in Luke 19. In that one, he gave each person a pound. One of them made 10, one of them made 5, the other one hid it in a napkin. And he likewise condemns him for being a slothful servant. So spending it is what fools do. I mean, spending all of it or most of it. Right, that's the whole purpose of saving is, you know, to save for the future. Doing nothing with it is what slothful, unambitious, and fearful people do. And investing it is what diligent and prudent people do. In this parable, again, in Matthew 25, verses 14 through 17, look at what this man did. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his servants, his own servants, and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received 5 talents went and traded, or invested, in other words, with the same, and made them other 5 talents. And likewise, he that had received 2, he also gained other 2. Right? So they took the money that the Lord gave him. And this is talking about money. Now, there's a spiritual lesson here, right? But the primary thing in the parable is money. He said, I took my money and given it to the exchangers to get right there in the next verse, in verse 18. Hid his Lord's money. So this is about money, okay? So they took the talents. Some were blessed. One guy had more. But he took his talents, he invested them, and he doubled his money. 5, and he ended up with 5 more. The other guy took his 2 talents, and he invested it, and he ended up with double his money. He ended up with 4. That's what investing does. Investing grows your money. And the Lord was very pleased with these investors, verses 20 through 23. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. So he invested, and the Lord didn't say, oh, that was foolish. You took a risk in the stock market. What are you thinking? No, he commended him for investing and getting a return on his money. Verse 22, he also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. See, they're commended for investing. Verses 28 and 29. Take therefore the talent from him and give it unto him that hath 10 talents. For every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. You know, and people say, they complain that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Now, when that's due to government and all that and inflation, that's wrong. But, you know, in general, that's what happens. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. You know why? Because of their decisions. That's why. That's why. If the poor change their minds, they'll get wealthy too. It's, especially in America today, it's not all that difficult. I'll talk about that here yet today, hopefully. So God blesses those who are good stewards of what he's given to them. Notice that it's God's money. Did you see that in verse 20? Verse 20, and so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. Right? The Lord gave him the money. It was the Lord's money to start off with. He gave it to him. Luke 19 and verse 16. When we manage our money, we are being stewards of the money that God has given us. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. It's all his. Luke 19 and verse 16. This is the parable of the pounds. Then came the first saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 10 pounds. Thy pound. Everything that we do with our money, we are managing it for the Lord. It's God's money, all of it. We are just stewards of God's money, of what he has given us to take care of. If you start thinking about your money that way, you may be wiser with it when you realize, you know what? I'm like the steward. I live on the estate of the rich man, and I don't really own all the, I don't own any of this, but I'm just in charge of it. And I've got to manage it because the landowner, the master, he owns it all, and it's my job to take care of his stuff. If you start viewing your money that way, that it's my job to take care of the Lord's stuff, the Lord gave me this, and it's my job to manage it, you'll manage it a lot better. See, investing wisely enables a man to use his money to gain more money. Now, in the first parable, they doubled their money. Both of them did. The good ones doubled their money. In this parable, they did a lot more than that. Luke 19, 15 through 19. He gives them each a pound, right? And then expects them to go manage it wisely. And here's what they do. Luke 19, 15 through 19. And it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to be called unto him, to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading, by investing. Then came the first, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 10 pounds. He did a 10x investment. He did a 10-bagger. That's not 10%, that's 10 times. He made his money grow by 10 times. That would be like if somebody gave you $1,000 or $10,000 to manage, we'll say, and he comes back and you've made $100,000 with that $10,000. That's what investing can do. It takes time, but the Lord went into a far country and came back a long time later. You can 10x your money if you have enough time to do it. And I'm not talking about getting rich quick schemes. I'm talking about just normal investments that are available to every Tom, Dick, and Harry. You can 10x your money if you have enough time. It takes years. It takes a long time. But it's totally doable. And I'll show it to you here in a minute. I didn't finish reading the passage. Verse 16, I'll read that again. Then came the first, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 10 pounds. And he said unto him, well, thou good servant, because thou hast been faithful in a very little, have thou authority over 10 cities. See, if you're faithful with the little money God gives you, don't be surprised when he gives you more, because you're going to be able to manage it well. Verse 17, and he, verse 18, and the second came, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 5 pounds. That's, 5x investment. That's good. And he said, likewise to him, be thou also over 5 cities. You've done well. Right? He blesses them both. Gain is to obtain or secure something which is desired or advantageous, to obtain a sum of money as the profits of trade or speculation, to be benefited to the extent of so much by any transaction or event, to obtain, earn, make a livelihood, to make a gain or profit, to be benefited or advantaged, whether pecuniarily, that has to do with money, or otherwise. You see, as I mentioned way back when, in the beginning of this series, wealthy people possess income-producing assets. Okay? Rather than wasting their money on consumer goods, wealthy people own income-producing assets, like companies, right? And when you own stock in a company, you own part of that company. You own a share. That's why it's called a share. You own a share of that company. Anytime you buy a share of Apple and you are a part owner in the multi-trillion dollar corporation of Apple. I mean, you're a little wee part. You're like a, an infinitesimal part, but you are a part owner. You own that company along with millions of other people. This is what wealthy people do. They own income producing assets. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 2. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 2. It says, the rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds. And as I mentioned before, those are income-producing assets. Flocks and herds produce meat. They produce more flocks and herds, right? They produce wool. They produce, depending on what their flocks and herds of, they could produce, alpacas produce another kind of wool type of stuff. They produce milk. Right, they can do labor and work. Oxen can pull plows. Whatever, right? They are productive. This is productive stuff. See, the rich man didn't have a bunch of consumer goods. He had flocks and herds. Now, wealth building takes time. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And I can't emphasize this enough. Wealth building is a marathon, not a sprint. You try to get rich quickly, you are not going to. I've already showed you that verse, Proverbs 28:22. He that hasteth to be rich, right, hath an evil eye. Poverty shall come upon him. You can't do it quickly. Slow and steady wins the race. Dave Ramsey told in his book how he interviewed a bunch of millionaires, and he decided he wanted to interview some billionaires. Because millionaires and billionaires are a totally different animal, right? They're just as different as night and day. So he wanted to interview some billionaires, and he interviewed a billionaire. And this guy was a Christian man, older, in his 70s, I think. And he was a billionaire. I don't know how much money he had, but he was a good, godly man. And Dave wanted to know, kind of like, what's the secret? What's the trick here? How do you get to be a billionaire, right? Becoming a millionaire is easy. I mean, relatively speaking, you just follow these simple steps, and like literally anybody, you just follow these steps, follow the baby steps. Anybody can become a millionaire. It's totally doable. Billionaire is a different story. Not anybody can become a billionaire. Like almost nobody can, because that's a totally different animal. So anyway, he asked the guy, like, what advice do you have for me? He's like, well, Dave, I'm going to give you a book. I'm going to recommend you a book. He's like, oh, great. I love reading. He's like on the edge of his seat. I can't wait to read this book and find out how to become a billionaire. And he said, I've read this book like 100 times. I've read it to my children. I've read it to my grandchildren. I've given it to a whole bunch of people. Highly recommend it. And he's just like eating it up. He just can't wait. He says, the book is The Tortoise and the Hare. Read that book. That's what it's about. Building wealth is The Tortoise and the Hare. You can try to be the hare. You can try the get-rich-quick schemes. Or you can be the tortoise that just step after step. The hare's out there running, then the hare takes a nap, thinks he's got all the time in the world, and the tortoise just step after step after step, year after year, 15% of my income in my 401k, a few hundred dollars here, a few hundred dollars there, step after step after step, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and all of a sudden, boom, you're a millionaire. What happened to the get-rich-quick guy? He was off chasing this thing, chasing that thing, sleeping, thinking he had all the time in the world, and he goes nowhere. Thomas J. Stanley in The Millionaire Next Door said, or wrote, small amounts invested periodically also become large investments over time. Dave Ramsey in Baby Steps Millionaires, that's the new book that I just read, he said, diligently investing your money little by little over time is where real lasting wealth comes from. Simply put, the best way to get rich quick is to get rich slow. And Warren Buffett basically said the same thing. Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, billionaire himself, he was listening to Buffett saying, you know, people, Buffett says 99% of people ought to just buy the S&P. Just buy the S&P 500, sit on it for a lifetime, and you'll be fine. And Bezos said, why don't more people just listen to you then? I mean, here's a guy that's worth $150 billion. Obviously, he knows what he's talking about, you know, Buffett. Why don't more people listen to you? And Buffett said something to the effect of, because nobody wants to get rich slowly. That's why. Here's another quote from Baby Steps Millionaires. Beverly Sills, a famous opera singer, reminds us, quote, this is so good, there is no shortcut to any place worth going. There is no shortcut to any place worth going. That's so true. Our data from the National Study of Millionaires, that's the largest study of millionaires ever conducted, 10,000 millionaires. Our data from the National Study of Millionaires indicates that almost no millionaires get there quick and easy with one big hit. Only 3% received an inheritance of $1 million or more. Only 2% of millionaires surveyed said they came from an upper income family. 2% of millionaires came from an upper income family. That means the other 98% came from middle class. Middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class, normal people, in other words. 98% of millionaires came from normal, regular old families, just like all of us did. Not only that, but 3 out of 4 millionaires, 75%, said that regular, consistent investing over a long period of time is the reason for their success. In other words, they became wealthy slow and steady, not quick and flashy. You know, most millionaires are just normal people with normal incomes who are just wiser, more frugal, more disciplined, and more patient than most people. That's all there is to it. They're just normal people that are just wise and smart with their money. Frugal, patient, disciplined. That's it. They spend less, as I said before, they spend less on groceries, eating out, and clothing than the average person does. That's not what most people think of millionaires, is it? But that's the facts. Largest study of millionaires in the country, 10,000 of them, and that's what they found. Here's another quote from that book. Remember, it takes the average baby stepper 2.5 to 3 years to knock out baby steps 1 through 3. It takes the average baby stepper about 17 years or less to do baby steps 4 through 7 and reach a million. I'll quickly give you the baby steps. I'm going to cover them in detail at the end of the series. Step number 1 is save up $1,000 as fast as you can. Step number 2 is pay off all your debts except your mortgage with a debt snowball. So you start with the smallest one and work with a vengeance on that and then put all the money on the next one and so on. Pay that off. That's step number 2. Step number 3 is finish the emergency fund with 3 to 6 months of living expenses. That, he says, takes most people 2.5 to 3 years. Depends on how much debt you have. If you don't have any debt, well, then you just, you know, you wiped out like steps 1 and 2 and you no time. And step 3 wouldn't take you very much time at all. 4 through 7 is save 15% of your gross income, that's before taxes, into a 401k or IRA or retirement account. Step 5 is save for your kids' college. That's an optional step. Step 6 is pay off your house early. You know, so whatever money you have left over of the 15% you're investing, that all goes on your house and you pay the house off. You know what the average millionaire, you know how fast the average millionaire paid off his house? And remember, these millionaires are normal people, right? They're not like, you know, these huge, uber wealthy people and just pay it off with, you know, cash or something like that. A few of them do, but you know how long the average millionaire took to pay off his house? 10 years. 10 years. That's what the average millionaire took to pay off his house. So he says there, and then step seven is then to build wealth and live like no other and give like no other. That's the last step. That's the whole purpose of it. If you forget the give like no other, forget about it. If you want to build wealth because you just want to be wealthy and you don't want to give like no other, forget about it. You're wasting your time. You're missing the point. So he says there, basically to get out of debt and have an emergency fund takes 2.5 to 3 years. Then from that point, when you start investing, when you have zero saved for retirement, you start investing, it takes on average about 17 years to hit $1 million. 17 years. Now, I think that would include home equity in his calculation here. But still, 17 years. You went from being dead broke in debt to no debt and $1 million in assets in about 20 years. About 20 years. And these are normal people. These are not people that are making $200,000 a year, even $100,000 a year. These are normal people. A dollar invested. Now, this is from a man named Raphael that he's quoting in Baby Steps Millionaires. This is a man that did what he teaches. This is also a man that was born in El Salvador, I think it was, in abject poverty, living in a mud hut, and his parents got into the United States as itinerant workers, like migrant workers, basically. And then he joined the military and got smart with his money and ended up a millionaire early in life. Rags to riches. He said, a dollar invested in your 20s has the ability to multiply itself over and over. Listen to this. This is so good. The key is time in the market, not timing the market. That is so powerful. The key is time in the market, not timing the market. You know what timing the market is? Timing the market is, I'm going to wait until the market crashes and I'm going to buy at the bottom, and then I'm going to hold on to it until it gets to the top, and I'm going to sell at the top, and then I'm going to wait until it goes down again and buy. You can't do that. Nobody can do that. There's not a person on the face of this earth that can do that unless it's just by sheer dumb luck. You cannot do that. Nobody. Warren Buffett can't do it. The greatest investors of all time, nobody can do that. Nobody can time the market. Nobody knows when the bottom's in. Nobody knows when the top's in. It always deceives people. You think, oh, it'd be really easy. I'll just wait until it gets up to the top and I'll sell. You don't know when it's at the top, right? Well, I'll just wait until when it gets to all-time highs and then it just dips a little bit. Well, you know what? It gets up to all-time highs. Maybe it crashes 5% in a day. You're like, oh, this is it. You sell. And then it just keeps going up for the next 10 years. And guess what? You're out and you just lost all those gains. Or it gets to the bottom. Oh, this has got to be the bottom. I'm going to buy right now. You know, so you buy right now. You throw your whole life savings into it. And then guess what? It goes down for the next 5 years still because it was just a little blip. Started to go up, went down again. Nobody can buy the top or the bottom. That's why you do what's called dollar cost averaging. You just buy every time you get paid, every 2 weeks, whether the market's up, whether the market's down, just consistently buy, and it averages out. Sometimes you're high, sometimes you're low. Just keep doing that. Investing money over long periods of time will yield huge profits, depending on the average rate of return and, of course, the Lord's blessing. Proverbs 10:22 says, "The blessing of the Lord, it maketh rich, and he addeth no sorrow with it." If the Lord blesses you, you know, you can invest and do very well if he blesses you. I'm going to give you some examples, and then we're going to be done. I really wanted to get to this part because this is the most interesting, exciting part. I went to RamseySolutions.com, to their investment calculator. You can go there, RamseySolutions.com/retirement/investment-calculator, or you can just type in Dave Ramsey. You'll find Ramsey Solutions. Go there, go to the menu, click Tools, go down to Investment Calculator. And there you can enter your age, what age you want to retire at, how much money you currently have to invest, and then how much you're going to put in every year or month. Is it every year or month? I forget. It's every year, I think. I think it's every what you're going to put in every year or every month. I don't remember. And then the rate of return that you think you'll get. Right. So I chose 10% because that's the 100-year average of the S&P 500. Over the last 100 years, on average, the S&P has grown 10% per year. Some years it went way down, some years it went way up, but on average, 10%. You can do this too. It's really easy. Now, last Sunday, I misspoke. I said if you started at 18 years old and you put $7,000 in a Roth IRA, which is the max that you can put in every year, if you did that, you'd be a millionaire at 40. I was wrong. I was off by 6 years. If an 18-year-old kid invested $583.33 per month, which is $7,000 per year, which is the current limit on a Roth IRA, I'll talk about what a Roth IRA is, what a regular IRA is, what a 401k is, what a Roth 401k is. I'll talk about all that stuff next Sunday, Lord willing. It's just a retirement account. It's a taxed advantage retirement account. You put money into it that's already been taxed, and when you take it out at retirement, you pay no tax on the principal or on the gains. You pay no tax, period, if the government doesn't change the rules and screw you. So if an 18-year-old kid invested $583.33 per month, which you say that's a lot for an 18-year-old, well, number one, what's an 18-year-old that's living at home for the next 4 years if his parents are, you know, nice enough to let him live at home for a little while and save money? Is it a big deal for an 18-year-old kid to save $583 a month? That's nothing, right? That's just the money he'd go out goofing around with. If he did that at a 10% average rate of return, he would have $1,067,841 by age 46. He'd be a millionaire at 46 years old just by putting $7,000 a year into retirement, $583 a month into retirement. He'd be a millionaire by age 46. That's, of course, not including, by that point, if he's doing that, he's already bought a house and paid it off. He'd already have a house that probably has, these days, $300,000 or $400,000 in home equity. He's going to be worth a lot more than a million by age 46, obviously. If the same man kept investing the same amount until he was 65, you know how much money he'd have? This 18-year-old boy started $583 a month. He became a millionaire at 46 years old. If he kept investing that same amount, $583 a month, until he was 65, you know how much money he'd have? $7.5 million. $7,477,826. $7.5 million by simply putting a little over $500 a month into his retirement account over the course of a lifetime. $7.5 million. If he would have started at age 25, maybe he decided he was going to goof around and you know, not get serious for 7 years. So he starts at age 25, maybe after he gets out of college and gets a decent job. He'd have over a million dollars, $1,067,000 by age 53. All right, how about a 22-year-old kid that just graduated college? He's making $40,000 a year, so this is not unreasonable, right? If you get out of college with an IT degree, an engineering degree, a medical degree, any decent degree, science and technology, these days, 40 grand a year is nothing. I mean, that's, people have been getting out of college making that for a long time. If you get out with one of these other worthless degrees, you're going to be making, 12 or 15 bucks an hour at McDonald's. So choose wisely. But anyway, 22-year-old kid making 40 grand a year, not exactly, a Rockefeller. If he invested 15% of his gross income, which is $500 a month, at a 10% average rate of return, he would have $1,017,423 by age 51. Age 51, he's a millionaire by investing 15% of his income into an IRA at 10% interest. If he kept investing that same amount, he would have $2.1 million at age 58. He would have $4.2 million at age 65 and $7 million at age 70. Think about that. 15% of his gross income. That's assuming he never got a raise. What are the odds a college graduate at 22 making $40,000 a year is going to make $40,000 when he's 60? Come on. He's going to be making three times that much, four times that much, who knows what. All right, how about somebody that dropped the ball and didn't do anything, and realizes he gets to middle age, he's like, oh crap, I got nothing saved. 43-year-old man, I've got nothing saved. What am I going to do? Gets off to a late start. Say he makes $80,000 a year, which, you know, is not uncommon for a 43-year-old man. That's not, you know, that's more than some people make. It's less than a lot of people make. Makes $80,000 a year, starts putting 15% of his salary into his 401k. That's $1,000 a month. $1,000 a month into his 401k at 10% average rate of return. He would have $1,065,548 by age 66. By the time it's time for the average person to retire, right, this guy would be a millionaire, starting off at 43 years old, just putting 15% of his income if he made 80 grand a year. He'd have 1.6 million by age 70. His wealth would have grown in 4 years, it would have grown by almost $600,000. That's the power of compound interest. Now, it's biblical and commended by God to invest and multiply your money by many fold. Remember, Luke 19, thy pound hath made 10 pounds. He did a 10 bagger. It's biblical to do that. God doesn't say, that's wrong. Oh, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't invest and expect to 10 times your money over time. God says, good job. That's what you should do. Now, one other interesting thing. How many of you, before last Sunday when I mentioned it, how many of you had heard of the Law of 72? Law of 72s. Okay, one of you had. The Law of 72s is very interesting. You can use it to calculate how long it will take your money to double. And it's the simplest calculation ever. You just divide 72 by the interest rate and divide it by the interest rate whole number, like 10%, you divide it by 10. Don't divide it by 0.1, right? Divide it by 10, okay? So here are some examples. Money invested at 12% interest will double in 6 years. 72 divided by 12 equals 6, okay? Law of 72s. Money invested at 10% interest will double in 7.2 years. Money invested at 7.2% interest will double in 10 years. Money invested at 6% interest will double in 12 years. Money invested at 4% interest will double in 18 years. Just plug in any number there, simple calculation. That's the power of compound interest. If you can get 10% in the market, which is historically what the market does, every 7.2 years, basically every 7 years, you double your money. So if you invested $50,000 at age 30, 37, you've got $100,000. 44, you've got $200,000. 51, you've got $400,000. 58, you've got $800,000. 65, you've got $1.6 million. See, it doubles every 7 years at 10% interest. I hope I did all that math right in my head. I think I did. But if I didn't, you still get the point. Compound interest is powerful. Somebody said, I think Einstein falsely, this is attributed falsely to him, he said compound interest is the most powerful force in the universe, which is not true. Obviously, God is, but it is very powerful. So do you see how investing is critical when it comes to building wealth? Now, you may be wondering, how do I actually do this? Like, okay, I get it. I see the numbers. Yeah, like any Tom, Dick, and Harry can become a millionaire just by putting 15% of his income into a retirement account. How do I actually do that? That'll come next Sunday. Next Sunday, I will talk about where and how to invest your money and make it grow like this, if certain assumptions hold true. Maybe it's really different this time. Maybe the market will just go down for the rest of our lives. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. Who knows? But I'll talk about that anyway, and I'll talk about different ways to invest, different things to invest in. But the most important thing is just to get busy doing it. Just put that 15% of your income in a retirement account invested somewhere and trust God with the results. But we'll talk about all that next Sunday, Lord willing. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention.